My name is Martin Summers. My own experience of war is my most personal experience of war was that I was an aid worker in Bosnia during the war there, and probably one of the most challenging experiences of my life was I went into Mostar after the end of I was one of the first Western aid workers into East Mostar when the ceasefire was called after 18 months of siege of this small enclave, enclave.
That's the most important.
Yeah. And I must admit, I was frankly horrified when I went in there because they hadn't been eating properly, the people who were still alive, for 18 months. They'd been living in cellars under constant bombardment, and they were skeletal in the same kind of way as those pictures we saw from Belsen in the 40s. And the other striking thing was that because Muslims have to be buried the same day, that's part of their religion, and of course they're also under constant fire, every square centimetre of space had been turned into graves. So a football field was just graves where people had been buried. I went in there and I talked to people. And in fact, there was a positive experiences as well. The young people had been practicing a dance routine, like a traditional dance routine, for all the time they were there under fire, and they took great pleasure in dancing this dance routine for me and a few other colleagues in a basement with a generator going. And it was a kind of almost like a triumph of the human spirit, really, over the awfulness of the situation. But I don't want to go on too much about that. That's just to sort of introduce who I am. I was working for the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development at the time. I did study philosophy at university as part of my degree, so I do have some philosophical training. I'm quite active in the anti-war movement, as you probably guessed from my comments earlier. And so those are my kind of credentials to speak on this topic, if you like, which is why Tony suggested that I might want to do it. Now, when you think of war and peace, the first thing you think of, the first thing that came to my mind was War and Peace. Here it is, Leo Tolstoy's book. I'll just read you a short extract from it. This is about after the Battle of Borodino. The famous flank movement consisted simply in this. The Russian army, which had been retreating directly back as the invaders pushed forward, as soon as the French attack ceased, digressed from the straight course they had embarked on at first, and finding they were not pursued, naturally inclined towards the locality where supplies were abundant. If we imagine, instead of generals of genius at the head of the Russian army, an army acting alone, without leadership of any kind, such an army could not have done anything else but retire towards Moscow, describing a semicircle through country where provisions were the most plentiful and which was the richest. So natural was this transfer from the Nizhny to the Ryazan, Tula and Kaluga roads, that even the stragglers from the Russian army fled in that direction, and Petersburg ordered Kutuzov to take that route. At Tarutino, Kutuzov, who was the Russian general, received what was almost a reprimand from the emperor for moving the army to the Ryazan road, and he was enjoined to occupy the very position facing Kaluga in which he was encamped at the time the Tsar's letter reached him. Now, in other words, what Tolstoy emphasises in War and Peace is that war is like a kind of, almost like a weather event. And he contrasts Kutuzov's non-action to Napoleon's kind of hyperactivity. Napoleon wants to control events. He thinks he's in charge of things. He thinks that he's deciding what's going to happen. And the main philosophical point, in my view, of Tolstoy's book is to point out that war isn't really like that. That war is actually a kind of, it just happens, and one damn thing follows another. And that Kutuzov's kind of relaxed inactivity turns out to be exactly the right thing to do. Whereas Napoleon's hyperactivity, not least invading Russia in the first place, a bit like Hitler, was wrong and stupid, and a misunderstanding of the nature of war. And this also relates, in my mind at least, to some of the things you see in classical Chinese thinking about military affairs. So this is the Tao Te Ching, written by Lao Tzu in sometimes about 500 BC, I believe. Again, talking about warfare. Arms are implements of ill omen, which are abhorred by men. Therefore the man of Tau does not abide them. Arms are implements of ill omen. One uses them only when one cannot avoid it. Even if one engages in fighting, one should remain quiescent and indifferent. Even if the war is won, one should not glorify it. To glorify it means that one enjoys slaying men. If one enjoys slaying men, one will never be successful in the world. And also, another short piece, on military operations we have, I do not boldly attack others first, but take action only after being attacked. I do not boldly move forward even an inch, but withdraw a foot. This is called the operation of non-operation. Bearing the arms of non-arms, charging the enemy of non-enemy, carrying the weapons of non-weapons. There is no more serious misfortune than to engage in war lightly. To engage in war lightly is to violate my essential teachings of compassion, renunciation, and never longing to be first in the world. Therefore, when two armies join in battle, the one that is compassionate wins. And I think that Tolstoy was also, in War and Peace, hinting at this kind of aspect of warfare, that it's actually determined by almost inscrutable factors, and certainly not, certainly the kind of maps that generals make and the kind of straightforward grid they try to put on this experience is delusionary. And I certainly felt that in the chaos that was Bosnia. Mm. So, for example, we would go to British Army briefings before we set off into the day's activities, and there would be a huge map on the wall about the size of that wall, and there were lots and lots of squiggly lines all over it. And it was just astonishing, because there was lots of little pockets of different kind of groups controlling different areas. And they said, don't go in there today. We've got Iranian Mujahideen in there. They've said they're going to try and kidnap a British aid worker. Don't go into that village. And of course, your map reading skills get good when you're being told stuff like this. You really must get it right. Don't go into that village. I came home at one stage to find a fax on my desk saying, on no account should you go to Tuzla. I'd just come back from Tuzla. I'd actually been standing on a bus, strap hanging, with the Mujahideen standing right next to me. They'd had intelligence that they wanted to kidnap an aid worker. And these guys were standing right next to me on the bus, and I was strap hanging on the bus. Anyway, chaos in warfare, and therefore its unpredictability, and therefore it's something to be engaged in extremely reluctantly and with a great deal of circumspection. Tolstoy himself had served as an officer in the Crimean War at the Siege of Sebastopol, so a lot of the kind of graphic detail in the novel is drawn from personal experience. He'd seen people blown to bits and all the rest of it. The experiences of Tolstoy in the war and in warfare led him to a Christian pacifist position. So he became famous in later life for his pamphlets and articles about Christian non-violence, the refusal to fight in wars, the idea that, these generals and politicians and imperialists and whoever else it was would never be able to get away with what they were doing if the ordinary soldiers refused to fight. And a lot of Tolstoy's Gandhi read Tolstoy's essays when he was in London, and Tolstoy's thinking about this was greatly influential on Gandhi's non-violent resistance, ideas about non-violent resistance, Satyagraha, and so on. Now, in a sense, Tolstoy interpreted the Christian message as he saw it as absolutely and irrevocably pacifist. That has been a fairly obvious conclusion to draw from some things like the Sermon on the Mount, but historically Christianity has not been an entirely pacifist religion. In fact, it's always been a minority kind of strain within the religion to believe in absolute pacifism. Because obviously from a very early stage, the Christian founders of the Christian religion were in a world where war was a fact of life. Many of their adherents, for example, were soldiers, Roman soldiers like St. Martin, and therefore they had to come up with some other explanation about whether war was good, whether it was bad, how it was justified or not justified. And this ultimately led to what's known as just war theory. Now, just war theory is not entirely a Christian creation. Classical thinkers had also thought about what war What justified war? What was the place of war in human life? So if I just quote from this book here, this is quite a very interesting history book, God's War. It's a recent history of the Crusades. And it's talking about the classical ideas about warfare, which influenced the early Christian thinkers. So the 4th century BC Greek philosopher Aristotle coined the phrase just war to describe the categories of acceptable warfare. War provided a natural form of acquisition for the state, but should not be an end in itself. It could legitimately be deployed in self-defence, to prevent the state's enslavement, to obtain an empire to benefit the inhabitants of the conquering state, or to enslave non-Hellenes deserving of slavery. The key was the justice of the ends for which the war was fought. In his Politics, Aristotle insisted that war must be for the sake of peace. There was no concept of a religious war per se, and nor of religious disapproval of war, as public religion resembled a civic cult, and the needs of a victorious state were almost by definition just. So to Aristotle's just ends, Roman law added just cause, a causa belli, as the historian Livy put it, based on contractual relations. From the Latin for peace, pax, derived from the verb pangere, meaning to enter into a contract, it was argued that war was justified if one party was guilty of breaking an agreement or injuring the other. So we can still see the echoes of these kind of arguments going on in the run-up to the Iraq War. You know, just cause, weapons of mass destruction, do we go to the UN or not, all of these things, because it's a continuation of, you know, an eternal human dilemma, if you like. Christianity took some of these classical ideas and added to it its own justification. Apparently in translation, when Jesus speaks of forgiving your enemies, in the Latin, they do not use the Latin word hostus, which means public enemies. It means private enemies. Yeah, so you don't fight your private enemies, but the public enemies of society are regarded as fair game. And that was how, in a way, the Christian pacifist message of Jesus was reconciled with the needs of the Roman state. Which, of course, Tolstoy wanted to unpick that and say, look, the problem with Christianity as it's been practiced is it's been turned into a state religion by an empire, the Roman Empire. And that's where all this kind of accretion of acceptance of warfare has come from. Because he would have argued that Jesus' message is quite simple. You don't kill people, ever. That's all. Now, the way this played out historically, after the fall of the Roman Empire, you've got lots of warlords of various extractions fighting each other, preying upon the population. You know, the kind of chaos that we see now in many parts of the world, but played out on a smaller scale, if you like, in Western Europe. The church, which was the most educated section of that society, the people who had, you know, were literate and had access to previous learning and so on, did begin to evolve ideas for coping with this kind of endemic state of warfare that the world seemed to have fallen into. And they elaborated just war theory and the so-called idea of the truce of God. And they tried to encourage warlords by shaming them. They flattered the warlords and said, no, you're not warlords, you are knights, you are chivalric knights. And chivalric knights are kind to women. They protect the poor and the needy. They defend the community against aggression. And that is what you should be doing rather than fighting each other. And they used to have great big meetings where they would try and shame the knightly classes, from which many of the church's personnel were themselves drawn, into accepting these kind of ideas of limitation of violence as a means of solving political and personal problems. Now, this sounds like a very positive movement, and in many ways it was. We're talking now about the 11th century. Well, it's before, slightly before then. But of course, the upshot of this was Bernard of Clairvaux and Pope, I can't remember, Pope Gregory, I think it was, preaching the crusade, saying, stop killing each other and persecuting the poor in your own community. Look, there's all the Muslims over there. Go and kill them. The crusades. God wills it. You should go and rescue Jerusalem. So, paradoxically, like most of the things about war and peace in human society, a move towards peace becomes a move towards war. And you saw similar things happening after the French Revolution. The French revolutionaries believed in perpetual universal peace and the peace between different nations. But when they were attacked, suddenly it becomes a kind of glorious crusade, as it were, to drive back the forces of reaction, to conquer them and so on, which is where Napoleon comes in later on. So I want to move on now to the Islamic view of the justness or otherwise of war. Beyond the world of Islamic order, in the Dar al-Harb, the house of war, non-Islamic political structures and individuals were open to attack. All the world must recognise or embrace Islam through conversion or subjugation. Thus, on the Muslim community was enjoined jihad, struggle. In classical Islamic theory, i.e. traditionally from the 7th and 8th centuries, but possibly later, this took two forms. The greater, al-jihad al-akbar, the internal spiritual struggle to achieve personal purity, and the lesser, al-jihad al-askar, the military struggle against infidels. Both were obligatory on able-bodied Muslims. Unlike Christian concepts of holy war, to which the Islamic jihad appears to have added nothing, jihad was fundamental to the faith, described by some as a sixth pillar of Islam. In theory, fighting was incumbent on all Muslims until the whole world had been subdued, but it was a spiritual as well as a military exercise from the start, and a corporate, not an individual, obligation. In practice, after the first century of conquest, accommodation was regularly achieved across religious and political frontiers. Islam was not in a constant state of aggression against its neighbours and was no more actively militant than their enemies. Now, in recent times, we've heard an awful lot more about jihad than we had previously. I think one point to just re-emphasise is that there are two aspects to jihad. The main, the greater jihad, is the spiritual struggle against oneself, against one's weakness, one's selfishness, greed, sin, what have you. And the struggle, the lesser jihad, the use of violence that in order to spread the faith or protect existing communities, was a secondary aspect of jihad. Now, we've all, in recent years, learned to be horrified by the concept of jihad, and isn't this terrible? So I think it's important that we are clear about what we're talking about if we're going to condemn such an idea. But I'd like to remind people in this room that not very long ago, Britain and the United States and many of the Western powers were very happy with jihad. This book is called Jihad, The Secret War in Afghanistan. And it's written by a guy whose pseudonym is Tom Carew, but whose actual fact is an SAS soldier who trained the Afghan Mujahideen and fought inside Afghanistan with the Afghan Mujahideen during the 1980s against the Russians. Now, I'd just like to read a short bit from this book. He's just come back from Afghanistan, and he's on a flight back to Britain. So the flight was routed via the UAE, and for the first leg, was crowded as fuck with Pakistanis travelling there to work. But once they were offloaded, things were a little bit quieter, and I was able to get my head down for a few hours' sleep. We arrived at Heathrow about 8 on Saturday morning. We were met after passport control and taken out via a side door to a waiting car. We had a fast, easy run up the M4 into West London, and by 9:30 we were in Stag Place, being shown into a large conference room in Roebuck House, the same office building where we'd had our original briefing. There was quite an audience, some I recognised, Lachlan and John Miley. Others were introduced, like a US Marine Corps colonel called Fred Fox. The rest remained anonymous. For the first couple of hours, William spoke and answered questions about his side of the operation, liaison with the Hezbollah, logistics and a number of areas of which I had no knowledge. Then it was my turn, describing conditions on the ground inside Afghanistan, how the Soviets were operating, Mujahideen tactics, and so on. Late in the afternoon, I got to the opium shipments. But almost as soon as I said the words, three of the anonymous men got up and left the room. I stopped talking in surprise, but Lachlan told me to carry on. "Don't worry about them, Tom. They don't want to know about this part of the operation." Now, in other words, not only were we supporting, or our government supporting, an Islamic jihad, it was an Islamic jihad funded by the massive smuggling of heroin. Many young people in Britain were being addicted to heroin at that time, a price well worth paying in order to defeat the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. I'm sure you may or may not agree. At the end of the book, he writes, "When I think about Afghanistan now, it's with a sense of sadness and regret. The Afghan war was Russia's Vietnam. They couldn't sustain the losses they received there and maintain the arms race with the Americans. The ragtag irregulars of the Afghan resistance kept the Soviets fighting for 10 years. But then they let victory slip from their fingers as the country fell under the control of the Taliban, a fundamentalist sect who were, in effect, the last men standing at the end of the war. At least the Taliban are Afghans, I suppose." So, of course, there's an irony about that now, even if with hindsight, that he was kind of happy that at least the Taliban were Afghans, but apparently we're no longer happy that the Taliban are Afghans, and we intend to bring further civilization to their community by invading and fighting with the Taliban, the very people that we helped to bring to power in the first place, with methods which could be charitably described as gangsterish in the first place. Saturday's Guardian. This is about, there's a Grenadier Guards company who are in Afghanistan. It's their last night, and they're about to go out and have a rather important firefight. And before they go, they sing a song to the tune of "When the Saints Go Marching In." Go into war with A Company. A Company is going to war. We're going to beat and kill the ragheads. A Company is going to war. So the same fundamentally racist assumptions are underlying all of this, the ragheads. But nevertheless, soldiers also do learn an awful lot through what they do. And at one point, this one soldier says here, "The enemy fire was unbelievable. Everyone thinks that the Taliban are just some bums with AK-47s, but they are really good soldiers." So there's a kind of respect there, despite the fact that they are ragheads, despite the fact that we put them in power in the first place and now we're trying to remove them. Those complexities are rather lost on these 20-year-old Brits who are in the middle of this situation, not probably as well educated as most people in this room. Now, this kind of growth of Islamic extremism as a direct result of Western policy in Afghanistan in the 1980s might be regarded in a Tolstoyan fashion as an unintended consequence of the use of violence, of the prosecution of war. You think you're achieving one thing, and in actual fact you're doing something completely opposite or different or completely a tangent from what your ostensible goals might be. Now, that would be, if you like, a kind of poetic justice kind of way to finish this little presentation of mine. But I fear that the situation is somewhat worse than that, in the sense that even before the Soviet Union had fully disintegrated, right-wing intellectuals in the United States, particularly a chap called Samuel Huntington, had written a book called The Clash of Civilizations. And in that book, he was looking forward to a post-Soviet world. But in that post-Soviet world, he was looking for enemies. If you read the book, it's an attempt to try and create more enemies. Because I fear that underlying Western policy has been a situation in which the money to be made from having a huge military machine and running your economy around that huge military machine has just become a way of life for many of our leading politicians and businessmen and opinion makers and opinion formers. There's a book that I'll just show you. I won't read from these books. I just want to show you these books. This book is called Unholy Wars, and it's a pretty good analysis of the aftermath of the Afghan misadventure, if that's what it was, in the 1980s. It tends more to the Tolstoyan view that the Americans somehow, and the British as their allies, somehow just got it wrong in Afghanistan. They didn't realise the consequences of arming and training the Pakistani Services Intelligence Agency and their acolytes in the Taliban and Jaish-e Mohammed and all these other different groups which have sprung up. But nevertheless, it makes sobering reading, even if one just thinks of it in terms of this was just the unforeseen consequences of of the policy. And there's actually a film out at the moment called Charlie Wilson's War, which is about a senator who was involved in the whole business of funding the Afghan resistance and all the rest of it. I haven't seen the film. Apparently, it's not that good, but I'm just pointing out that you could draw the conclusion that what's happened here is that people think they're pursuing one goal, and they end up with something completely different happening, and then they have to, deal with the consequences of that, which leads to further consequences which they hadn't contemplated, and so on and so forth. That would be the Tolstoyan view. Now, the other potential point of view is expressed by the fact that the creation of these enemies is not, in fact, accidental. That the desire to create an Islamic enemy was fundamental to neoconservative thinking after the fall of the Soviet Union, and that Islam was chosen for two reasons. A, because it was easily caricatured as kind of reactionary, stupid, scary, whatever. And secondly, because it just so happens that all the countries that have got big oil supplies just happen to be Muslims. So that makes them a nice, easy elision of the two things, because really we want to go to war to control oil supplies, but ordinary people in the West wouldn't go to war for that, and rightly so. They need a just casus belli in order to motivate them. And so, of course, if we're under attack from crazy extremists, well, that then provides that motivation. I just want to draw attention to this book to finish my bit of the presentation. This book's called The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11. It's written by David Ray Griffin, who is actually a theology professor at Claremont College. It's got a foreword by Michael Meacher, who was the longest-serving Labour cabinet minister. I think he still has that distinction, even though he's no longer in the government. And David Ray Griffin, who we had to come and speak in Britain a couple of years ago now, made a presentation to us about this book. The New Pearl Harbor, the title is drawn from the Project for a New American Century document, which was signed by all of the leading lights in the Bush administration. And at one point it wistfully says in the prologue that absent some catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor, we will find it hard to persuade the American people to do what is necessary to control the world and get what we want. Mm-hmm. Hence the title, The New Pearl Harbor, because of course there are some very, very serious questions about what happened on that day. Now this presentation isn't about that, so I'm not going to go into that unless people want to go into it. But I'm hoping that by running through things in the way that I have, I've provided sufficient food for a discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. It's extremely interesting and a very valid point of view. Can't agree with it, but still.